One weakness of the digital age is the bloat of information we now have at our fingertips. Websites, emails, audio, video, and a ton of metadata add up to an ocean of ones and zeros that have no meaning without context. Still, there are many services out there trying to make visual sense of the information we swim through daily. A Google Maps search is nothing more than a visual representation of numerical coordinates on a grid, but it can tell you how close you are to the nearest bagel shop. A tag cloud on a blog measures how often certain words are used, conveniently representing the most popular topics. On today's show, we're going to take a look at data visualization, specifically at two folks who are trying to make sense of the experiences we have on the web with some brand new ways of visualizing and interacting with data. One, in pursuit of reducing web filtering around the world, the other in pursuit of art and enlightenment. Welcome to Radio Berkman. If you've ever tried web surfing in China or the Middle East, chances are you've encountered a message that reads,
"Access to the requested site is not permitted,"
or something like that. Even in the supposedly web-friendly West, your internet activity can be filtered by school libraries, by your employer, and sometimes by your ISP. One new project seeks to harness the wisdom of the crowds to identify the sites that are filtered, and by whom, in an effort to track down why. Herdic.org is the brainchild of Jonathan Zittrain, a professor of law at Harvard University and co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Jonathan spoke with David Weinberger about how crowdsourcing the problem of inaccessibility could lead to some real answers.
Right now, when you encounter a web block, you have no way of really knowing why or who or how. And interestingly, by combining people's experiences, I don't know why, but I'm blocked here, and somebody else says, I don't know why, but I'm blocked there, we actually can answer the question of why both of them are blocked. So it's a great example of being able to make a mosaic where any one person is ignorant, but together their very ignorance produces an answer.
And blocked means that when you try to go to a site, you fail?
Well, we define inaccessible very broadly. It means that for the subjective experience of the person surfing, he or she did not see what was expected. So the classic kind of block, the ones we study as part of the OpenNet initiative, are where there's a network blockage in the middle. So you're trying to access Amnesty International's website and you just can't get there. And it comes back with, sorry, the bits just didn't go anywhere. But we have a broader conception of inaccessibility to include if you go to YouTube and you're looking for a video and the video has been taken down, that video is inaccessible even though the website YouTube is perfectly accessible. So we define inaccessibility very broadly, and it might be for accidental reasons, it might be because the site is down, it might be because somebody's intentionally trying to block it, whether the party that runs the site or a party in the middle.
So if my server goes down for a little bit, somebody might end up reporting my site as blocked.
As inaccessible.
As inaccessible.
Exactly. And it is inaccessible to them. And in fact, if you see reports of inaccessibility pouring in from around the world, we can infer that, yeah, maybe the site itself is down rather than that there are lots and lots of blocks all over the world preventing people from getting there.
What drives Herdic? Why are you doing it? What do you expect to be done with this information?
Two major purposes drive Herdic. One is to produce information about the state of the internet, first starting with the web, in real time as it happens, which just doesn't exist right now. When you can't get somewhere, including in places where blocking and filtering are just very common, you don't know why, you don't know how, you don't know who. And so to be able to add that information to the world at large is very useful, and it might well let you know to whom to direct a complaint. It might let you know if you're running the website that you need to take countermeasures, and it may help academics and others study better why governments block and what they're obviously sensitive about, you know, what topics, what modalities are worrisome to them. The second major reason we do it is to test the proposition that the loosely coordinated activities of just a few people can make a big difference online, that we can build our way out of a problem or to answer a question. And once you get started in that mode, it's highly addictive. You realize the web really is yours to shape, and the biggest barrier is just persuading other people or enlisting them to, you know, participate with you in your cause. And here, I think the success of Herdict as a civic technology, it will rise or fall according to how many people are intrigued by wanting to contribute to and learn about blockages around the world.
So there are two basic ways that you can engage with Herdict.
Yes. One is you can download a little add-on, a toolbar, either for Firefox or Internet Explorer, and we're eager to see them available in all the browsers, that will, as you surf, indicate to you if others are reporting the sites that you're visiting as inaccessible to them. And if you're in the United States, where blocking tends to be very rare as a matter of national policy, although on corporate internet connections there might be quite commonly some form of filtering going on at the corporate firewall, you can see as you surf, I'm at CNN.com, but this indicator in the bar, a sheep that changes color, is telling me that either people far away in critical mass are telling me they can't get there, or people near me are telling me they can't get there. And you can learn more about it and see where it's blocked and who can't get to the stuff that you can so easily get to. And if you happen to run into a block, then you can easily use that toolbar to report it. And that will get others aware that you can't get there and be able to compare notes that way.
When you report it, what information is gathered or do you ask for?
It will gather your internet protocol address, which in turn is used to help localize where you are on the network. The numbers that were assigned are not random, so they give you a sense of who your internet service provider is, what country you're sitting in, that kind of thing. And then you have a chance to refine the report by saying, are you at school, at work, at home, in a company? And you can even add comments, so you might be able to more subjectively express the nature of the problem you're trying to report.
In the list of where you are, if you say company, do you specify which company?
Oh, yeah. I mean, generally, very big companies will be their own internet service providers. So the software may even naturally pick up that you're coming from Boeing or GM or Google or something like that. If your company farms it out and you're on, AT&T, but your company is, Tool and Die Works, you would then have a chance, if you wanted, to more specifically say where you're coming from. Your personal identity is not released out of these reports, and there's not identifying information automatically generated that gets published.
So I'm blocked from a site, I press the sheep,
right.
Press the button, I report it as blocked, you get my IP address automatically.
Right.
What do you do with that IP address? Should I be at all concerned that people are going to see that I'm trying to get the blocked sites?
No, I wouldn't be that concerned. If you're trying to get to the blocked site, ISPs can already see that you're trying to get to the blocked site because they're the ISP that's trying to route the packets or not, as the case may be. When you make the report, it becomes publicly known that somebody at that ISP has reported it, but it doesn't say who in particular, even by IP address. That address will get stored in our database, but never advertised publicly, and our database is under lock and key.
The second way that we can participate in Herdict.
The second is actually to visit herdict.org, herdict.org. And when you go there, you have a chance to see the reports as they're coming in from around the world. In fact, the very homepage of Herdict shows a Google Maps mashup of reports as they're coming in from various countries around the world. And then you can enter what we call the Herdict Reporter. And with that, you can see a sequence of sites. A little frame is put up, and your browser will try to load one at a time, sites that have been reported as blocked around the world, and you have a chance to weigh in. And it both shows you what other people can't get to and also lets you help the triangulation process. So you can say, well, I can get there. Or you can say, if it's a site that is down for everyone or it's a piece of content that's been taken down for everybody, gee, I can't get there either. And that will help all of us know better where and what the filtering represents.
And of course, this is not a circumvention device. So if you're in, let's say, a country that's blocking a site and you go to the reporter.
You go to the reporter, the whole point is for it to be inaccessible to you then. You're just trying it through your traditional connection so that you can say it's inaccessible. It won't show you what other people are seeing. At some point, that functionality might be added. But our vision for Herdict is not as a circumvention tool to start with. There are plenty of those. But instead, as a kind of digital nervous system, so we just know what's going on our web.
From this, we will get reports of sites that are inaccessible. Some of them have been blocked for political reasons, one assumes.
Yes.
Governments, in fact, the Open Net Initiative does something similar. But we'll also get reports of sites that are just down for one reason or another, or taken down for copyright reasons or whatever. Will the system be able to sort those out?
Well, we're hopefully providing the raw materials so that that can be sorted out. There's only so much you can do mechanically, but part of our aim with Herdict is to develop a community of people who may have a special interest in YouTube or in that Tibetan dissident site, and will be located around the discussion page for that particular site on herdict.org. And so there will be people, we hope, with expertise that will be there. And when you go to look up the site report, you'll actually see their comments added in to say, here's what we think is going on. And the active analysis can then be distributed.
You have been involved in the OpenNet Initiative. Can you explain the relationship of the two projects?
Well, the OpenNet Initiative is a joint effort of Harvard and the Berkman Center on the one hand, and the University of Toronto and its Citizen Lab on the other, and at other times has involved the University of Cambridge and University of Oxford. And it has been an attempt to rigorously enumerate the tens of thousands of instances of internet filtering that take place around the world, big and small. That initiative has produced a book, a co-edited book called Access Denied, which enumerates filtering in some nearly 50 states around the world, and which has some essays, broader thinking about the state and trajectory of internet filtering and censorship. So this is a natural outgrowth of OpenNet, trying to come up with other ways to enumerate that filtering, and a nice feed of data into it so that the OpenNet researchers have much more to start with when they start to investigate filtering in a country. They have all these reports to work with rather than just on their own trying to figure out what to ask about as to what's blocked and what's not.
You've talked about the benefits of simply the fact that this will be a participatory process. What do you see as those benefits?
I think it's important to the preservation of the spirit of the internet and its technologies that a critical mass of its users really see themselves as participating in its use and in its build-out. If we get people who just see it as a cash-and-carry network, like they pay for their cable TV service or they just sit and listen to the radio, it will evolve in that direction, and that will be that. And a lot of the things that innovate out of left field that draw upon people's participation will not crystallize anymore. So in the broadest sense, this is an attempt to get people to see themselves as global netizens, as people who are engaged in a collective effort with lots of other people that they have never and will never meet in producing humanity's information medium. So that's like the largest sense of Herdict Web. And in that sense, it doesn't stop there. I mean, there are other flavors of Herdict for PC health so that computers that can run any code in a heartbeat and be compromised in a heartbeat have a way of signaling each other when they've been compromised, and you get a digital nervous system at the endpoints. So there's just one small step in getting people to experience and warm up to some of the original ethos of the internet that made and make it so different from the proprietary networks that it beat out, but that are ready for a second or third round and could in that round win.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Want to see the Herdict tool in action? Want to find out why it's called Herdict? Take it for a spin at herdict.org. Back in the day, a Rorschach test or a palm reading might be the most dependable methods of interpreting who we are and where we might be going in life. Today, a glance at our conversations online would be like giving Freud a high-powered rifle scope. Interpreted the right way, our Twitter posts, emails, and blog entries can say more about our relationships and personalities than years of therapy. A new exhibit at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology called Connections offers some exciting ways of visualizing the data that make up our lives. Judith Dunneth is director of the Sociable Media Research Group at MIT. She spoke with David Weinberger about how the exhibit came to be.
It's basically a two-part exhibit. One part is a series of design pieces, both past and present, that my students and I have been doing as part of research into sociable media, and it's a retrospective of those pieces. And then there's a big new installation art piece called Metro Pathologies.
Well, let's start with part one of Connections. What sort of work is there?
Our research has been looking into thinking about what the future of social interfaces can be. So one part is sort of our earliest abstract graphical interface called chat circles, and a more recent one called information spaces. And these are chat spaces that use abstract graphics instead of avatars to try and develop a vocabulary that's meant for the online world. And so those are there. Visitors can use them. There's a couple of interactive avatar sculptures. They're not going to be interactive in the show, called Chit Chat Club, and a series of data portraits, which is an area we've been really interested in, is thinking about how in the 21st century, as so much of our interactions are online and through online communication, what is the 21st century version of the photograph, where it's not a picture of the photons bouncing off your face, but a picture of your data and your interactions over time. So there's a series of pieces that look at what data portraits can be.
How far back in time do these go?
The chat circles piece is the oldest, and that's from 1998, and it's paired with a piece from last year. The data portraits are two contemporary ones and one from a series from 3 years ago, where the technology was developed 3 years ago. That one is called Theme Mail, for instance. That one is, it's interesting. It looks at the problem of how do you portray relationships that you have online via email. And it's a program that lets you take your email, lots of people save all their mail, and look at what are the words that you use with uncharacteristic frequency with another person. So, and then it shows that over time as a histogram of word usage. So you can see how this particular relationship develops. There's one piece that's called Roommate, that's a student did with a relationship with their roommate. Another is called Mom, or Mother, I think. That was another student's relationship with his mother. And I have a piece called Before and After Marriage, which is from before I met my now ex-husband all the way to the present.
What's that like?
That, I think it's an interesting one. What's interesting about this piece is because it only uses single words, it doesn't feel like it's an invasion of privacy, but you do get this rhythm of the type of words, this range from great, okay, happy, see you, love, to schedule, weekend, arbitration, therapist, over time. So you get to see, you can start to see little things. You can see the appearance of, things like labor, delivery, announcement.
So in what sense is that? I mean, that sounds intensely private, even though they're just single words.
Well, you have to see for yourself.
Well, I intend to. and the second part?
The second part deals much more directly with these issues around privacy. It's a large, very large installation piece called Metro Pathologies. And here we were interested in not so much making an interface for that is to be the future, but something that was really about giving people a very visceral sense of sort of a slightly heightened version of the world we live in now, where there's a constant bombardment of information, where at any given time you can have streams of information about global news, streams of information about a particular individual's thoughts, what they're doing, how long have they been waiting online. So it's this huge range of constant information that can alternate between being the sense of this very vibrant and exciting world where everything is alive and connected to something that's very, very overwhelming. And it's also a world in which you yourself become part of that data stream, whether it's willingly by, keeping blogs or posting on Twitter, to being, in a city where there's a constant set of surveillance cameras, you might be caught in Google Maps by accident, so you yourself are an information source. And it's an installation piece that tries to distill this into a experience you walk through.
Can you say a little bit more about what that
looks like?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what that looks
because
like.
Because all of the art is in
the representation.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's about 40-some-odd columns that you walk among that are sort of an abstraction of a cityscape. And there's a set of projections on them, and all the projections are drawn from live data streams. And
Actual
data.
Real-life live data.
Live data. And there's sound. And the sound, for instance, is also live data. We draw from a whole series of newscasts. It's run through a lot of computer processing, so it's more electronic music-like, but if you listen carefully as you go through, you'll realize that the words that are making up this music are that day's news. So, you know, last week you've got a lot of Tom Daschle. You know, this week it might be fires in Australia. Different spaces, different parts of the space deal with entertainment news, some deal with world news, some deal with politics. And so in the images, there's pieces like that. You get bits and pieces of current data, and it goes through a certain rhythm from being sort of very, very vibrant to being more sort of paranoia-inducing. There's also a series of three screens which deal more directly with you as a data source. And also part of the audio might be your voice. When you go in, it may record your speech with the people elsewhere in the exhibit. We have cameras there. And when you look in the screens, there are, one of the screens shows the space that you are in, and then these data ghosts wandering through it so that you can see your space, but all the data that moves through it. Another one takes images of the people who've been there throughout the whole exhibit and starts to build a city of visually of all the visitors. And then another piece is about how computers actually process the words that you type in. And you can type in a name, your name, and it just starts to try and figure out from the information it can gather online about that name what kind of person it is.
It sounds amazing, and I'm gonna have to go see it to get the full effect, but that's exactly the point.
Exactly.
Isn't it? What effect do you want it to have? Do you expect it to have on people once they started here and they've ended there and they're going out the door?
I mean, particularly with Metro Pathologies, what we want to do is provoke people to think about these issues in a much less didactic way. I think there's a whole set of people, certainly around Berkman, who are fascinated by thinking about surveillance and privacy and data. And then I think for a lot of other people, it's a topic that comes up, but it doesn't necessarily grab their attention, or it just seems like either it's scary or it's irrelevant. And I think the idea here was to make something that was very visceral, that was very thought-provoking, and that might draw people into thinking further about these issues, both pro and con, because it will have grasped their interest.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can catch Judith's exhibit with the Sociable Media Group at the MIT Museum at 265 Massachusetts Avenue in Cambridge, now through September 10th. There will also be an impressive series of lectures on data portraiture and other exciting topics. Find out more about the exhibit at web.mit.edu/museum. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find more programs like this and subscribe to our podcast at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.